It is Saturday, September 17th, 2011. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the Central Coast of California. This is Public Radio KUSP. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Miles Elam. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today's theme is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music, and it is Creative Commons, as is the show. And Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Dr. Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz. Specializing in handcrafted dentistry from start to finish using digital technology for less radiation and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. Learn more online at RamirezDDS.com. With me in the air room is Ben Jaffe, a freelance media guy, Stanford instructor, media designer for Tandy Beals Here and After at Cabrillo.
Here after here. Here and after. Yeah, that show was fun. It finished last Sunday. It closed last Sunday.
Wonderful. And it went well?
It was phenomenal. It was fantastic. Just like last year, the year before, or the years before. So, yeah.
In the second half of the show, we'll be inviting you to join us via phone with questions and comments about technology. But in the meantime, we're going to start off with some geek news. Ben, what's your first story?
Well, I wanted to talk about exoplanets because they're one of...
Sorry, what are exoplanets?
They're one of the... Yeah, okay. So, exoplanets are... basically planets that are orbiting stars, which is, I guess, what a planet is, that are outside of our solar system.
So planets orbiting other stars.
Yeah, planets orbiting other stars. So not Uranus, Neptune, all of our planets. We're talking about planets in other solar systems. And we have a number of ways of detecting them. Actually, I covered that a couple shows ago, which you can probably find. But one of the satellites that we have up in the orbit around the Earth that's looking for exoplanets is called Kepler, and it just found a very strange exoplanet. It is an exoplanet that is orbiting two stars. So orbiting
two stars at the same
binary pair of stars.
That's a very curious orbit.
It's Tatooine, right? From Star Wars.
So I'm assuming the stars are very close to each other, and the planet is...
Well, the stars are orbiting each other. So it's a binary star system.
But they're close to each other relative to the planet. The planet's probably further off.
Yeah, that's true. Although it's interesting, actually the distances in the star system are kind of strange. They're kind of similar to Earth, except that the planet is very different and the stars are much, much smaller. So as far as temperatures, you probably wouldn't want to live on this. It's in Fahrenheit, negative 100 to negative 150 Fahrenheit, so very, very, very cold, just because of the stars being a little bit smaller than the sun. But this is only somewhat new news. We have actually found exoplanets discovered orbiting stars in a binary star system, but we haven't yet discovered until now planets that are orbiting a binary star system. So
when a binary star, you're talking about we found exoplanets that are revolving around
one of the stars,
and the two stars revolving around each other.
Exactly. So you can have these two stars that are really, really far away from each other, that are really slowly orbiting each other, and then each of them could even conceivably have a solar system. And that's what we've discovered before, but this is the first time we've discovered a planet that is orbiting a set of stars. So kind of cool. It's Kepler 16b is the planet name.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
I have a story. Unfortunately, it's not quite as cool as yours.
Aww.
It has to do with the PlayStation Network. We've talked about this before on the show where someone was able to hack into the PlayStation database.
That was the one that was compromised three times, right?
Yes. and it was taken offline for 40 days. With credit card information stolen.
Was that in between the attacks? Or was that...
After the attacks, when they were trying to shore up the defenses and
harden
get back
up
again.
Yeah.
Well, this time Sony has I don't know, push the envelope. Uh-huh. No, they haven't been hacked again. That's the good news.
Okay.
The bad news is that they have decided that they're going to do a mandatory update for the PlayStation. So that's usually a common thing with
that's
PlayStation.
Fine,
they're doing a software update. And presumably they're doing a software update to update some security holes as well. Mm-hmm. The bad part is that if you take this update, part of the terms of agreement for this update are that you are not allowed to sue Sony.
Oh, no. What?
You would have to go to a binding arbitration rather than... So you cannot join into a class action suit, which is something that's in progress right now for Sony because of the previous break-ins. And if you don't take this mandatory update, you can't connect to the PlayStation Network.
Should that be legal? I mean,
I'm sure a lot of people are going to be upset about it and try to challenge it. I don't know the legality of it.
Because, like, I mean, what a precedent that would set, you know? Like, every company in the world could decide, you know what, we're just going to update our software and, you know, you just can accept the new end user license agreement and all that. And then, oh, yeah, no one's going to sue us ever. Like, that's horrible.
Well, they can complain. They just can't take it to court. They'd have to go through an arbitration.
But doesn't that remove accountability for Sony, or at least to a large part?
That's the open question. And we'll see how this plays out.
Oh, geez. That's bad.
Your next story.
My next story. You know, so I was covering that last story and I was thinking to myself, you know, God, there's something else that I'm forgetting, and it's because there are actually two stories on Kepler-19b, and so I'm going to cover the other one, the exoplanet. Yes. So the other really interesting thing about this planet is that its orbit is a little bit unusual, right? It's not like an elliptical orbit or something, because we know we have plenty of things that have elliptical orbit. In fact, everything has an elliptical orbit. Nothing's perfectly circular.
Yeah, although I do have to say, just as a shout out to the folks out there on behalf of the astronomy community, the orbits of the planets in our solar system are actually very close to circular. Mm-hmm. Whenever you look in textbooks and they look highly elliptical, that's because they're transforming that plane or translating that plane so that you're seeing it almost almost
edge on.
Yeah. And so we have this thoughts of like, oh yeah, well it goes in close and then zips out again, like what you see with comets. Comets have many times that highly elliptical orbit. But
yeah,
in fact,
if Earth did that, we would be scorched every summer, like, or really, really scorched.
Right. So while we are in fact in an elliptical orbit, it is in fact, because it's not a perfect circle, but it is fairly circular. The planets are all fairly, pretty circular. Pluto's less so, but yeah.
Well, but Pluto's a dwarf planet.
Okay, so it doesn't really count as a planet. That's fine. sorry to interrupt. I just had to do that little geek bit there.
Yeah, so this orbit is really, really strange. And astronomers looking at this started to get suspicious because this planet sometimes would speed up and sometimes it would slow down.
Oh, so it's getting dragged from one star in one direction, dragged from the other in another, or is it...
No, wait, hold on a second. No, I'm sorry. I totally messed this up. This is not 16b, this is 19b. I'm sorry, this is a separate planet.
Okay.
This is also discovered by the Kepler telescope.
Separate planet in a different system.
Separate planet, different system, completely different situation.
Okay.
But anyway, so sorry about that. This world will speed up, slow down. It has a 9-day orbit, which means we can, you know, over the course of, let's say, the last year, we could see this orbiting over and over again many, many, many times during this year, and we could really pinpoint a lot of detail about its orbit. And it turns out that we are postulating that there is another planet in the system which is influencing the orbit of Kepler-19b.
Oh, so we're using the same techniques that we find exoplanets many times. By the star
oh,
wobble.
Yes. Yeah.
So we're looking at the wobble of that.
No,
planet.
No. Kepler looks at the what's the name? What's the word for it? Ocular. When the planet eclipses the star, the word's going to come to me when it's not relevant anymore in this discussion.
The occlusion.
Occlusion. Thank you. Yes. Okay. So Kepler looks at the occlusion of the star by the planet, or of the planet by the star.
Okay.
Where
when
the planet
passes by
passes
the
in
amount
front
of light that.
Exactly. So, you know, when you walk in front of a light, then the light source gets dimmer because you're blocking some of the light. Same thing with the planets. And so, obviously, this technique can only be used on stars that have planets which are passing exactly between our telescopes and the star. So a very, very small subset of systems out there that have planets can we detect using this method.
Yeah, the plane of the system is in line with our plane. Or no, their plane is in line with their direction. Sorry.
Their plane is in line with our direction.
Their plane of revolution around the star is in our direct field of, like, we're looking directly at the system, and that angle that the planets are revolving around is the same as is parallel to.
Parallel to,
the angle that we are looking at the.
Exactly. Okay. So anyway, blah, blah, blah. But you know what's really cool about this is, you know, we've been discovering exoplanets through a couple different methods and mechanisms. And again, I covered that on a previous show. But in short, it's the occlusion method and also the star's wobble. So as the star wobbles because of the orbit of the planet around it dragging the star forward and backward and left and right, we can actually see a Doppler shift. And that's the other way that we can detect planets. But this planet, this ghost planet.
Doppler shift, we're talking about a visual Doppler shift.
Visual Doppler shift, okay. Not the ambulance passing by, but that with light, you know.
So for the folks out there that aren't familiar with that visual things, light does the same thing that sound does when something passes by. So that train whistle as it's passing by.
Yeah, and it goes down because the train's moving.
Yeah, as opposed to light, which is turns more bluish as it heads towards us and then turns more reddish as it moves away from us.
Yes.
Also known as redshifting.
Also known as red and blue shifting. Yeah, exactly. As the light waves get shorter, it gets more blue. As they get longer, it gets more red. But anyway, what I was saying with this though is we can take a look at Kepler-19b and we can intuit, because of the fact that it gets like 5 minutes faster, 5 minutes slower or whatever, we can intuit that there's another body, probably a planet, influencing its orbit, slowing it down ever so slightly or speeding it up ever so slightly. And that planet we have named Kepler-19c. And the really interesting thing about this to me is that we have not actually directly observed 19c. We've indirectly observed 19c by looking at its gravitational effects on 19b. So we don't really know exactly what it is. It could be a really, really big planet with a particular kind of orbit. It could be a really small planet with a particular kind of orbit, a different kind of orbit.
But it's irregular enough that they know that it's not just a highly elliptical orbit.
I'm not sure about that. I do know that the only thing that it says in the Kepler observation log is that it's less than 30 something point something Earth masses or something. That's something like that. They're just like,
you let out a number that had no
30 something point
use
something
whatsoever.
Well, okay, I can look for it in the article, but it's kind of fun though. It's interesting. We just don't necessarily know what this planet looks like, but we do know some very, very basic restrictions on what it can't be. And that's all we know.
And you will put up the measurement up on our website after the show so that people can look it up.
I'll put the link. You know, it's possible. Oh, here it is. Here it is. The only entry under the Kepler-19c in the mission's discovery page on the Kepler mission page is an approximation of its mass less than 31.6 Earth masses. There you go. Bam. Done.
Okay.
So that's all we know about Kepler-19c. It's also possible it's something else, but I think it's kind of interesting to say, yeah, we discovered a planet based on its influences on a planet that we can't directly observe. That's kind of fun.
Speaking of something that you can't directly observe, you are listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. If you want to join us with questions and comments about technology, the phone numbers are 800-655-5877. And also a story that is changing orbits, well, in a very different and highly metaphorical sense. Internet Explorer 10 is Microsoft.
You're a segue master.
Oh, I am? Okay. Is planning on ditching Flash and other plugins like Silverlight and like, but only in their tablet version, which is working on ARM. So the standard desktop with Windows 8 apparently will still be using the setup that you can use all your existing software. But it's a very strong departure when they're moving towards the their Metro, what they're calling Metro-style touch-friendly browser. Metro being the brand name for their portable devices or their tablet-like devices. And they are saying, okay, no Flash, no Silverlight. We're going to go absolutely full bore onto HTML5 and
Microsoft web standards? What? That's kind of cool, though.
Which is also throwing a fair amount of the Microsoft developer community into a bit of a hubbub of saying, like, wait a second, we signed on to .NET and we signed on to Silverlight and we signed on to doing these things, and now suddenly the rug is being pulled out from under them. But at the same time, they still have the same facilities for desktop systems, so that still has a continuity.
They are pulling an Apple.
They are pulling
the rug out from under their developers and stopping support on Adobe products, as well as their own Silverlight. That's interesting.
But we'll see how that goes, because Microsoft has been going in this direction with Internet Explorer 9 and 10, where they are trying to push more towards standards-based web development. Even IE10 went closer in that direction in its own meager way. And that wasn't the only browser news out there. Chrome 14 arrives.
Chrome 14.
Right now.
Wait, are we covering this story?
Yeah, the reason why I covered it is because it has improved line support. That was a problem they had in the past. But the news that I wanted to bring up.
Do you know if they have full screen support for Lion?
Yes, they do.
Running Lion,
that's,
by the way.
Yeah, that's the.
After I eschewed...
Okay, you can cover this after I cover this browser thing.
Oh, I didn't want to.
The reason why I want to bring up Chrome 14 is not because, oh, it's another number, because they've been getting new numbers out every 6 weeks or so. It's pretty ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But they have introduced by default their native technology called NACL, or sodium chloride native client, NACL. And what this is a sandbox. Some people compared it to ActiveX, but it is a fundamentally different technology in one way. It is not necessarily specific to one. It's not technology that's made for the. For example, with ActiveX, it was the Microsoft COM object model. Mm-hmm. It was a COM object that had been made available for scripting. NACL is made on the concept of, we don't trust native apps. We're going to put this inside of a sandbox, and they've put in a lot of safeguards to make sure that you are not allowed to do certain things. In other words, they scan that input, that binary input, to see, is it doing anything that looks like it would be something untoward, like some really weird pointer arithmetic, is it trying to overflow a buffer. These are common ways that you can exploit a browser with native code to, or any program for that matter, to get access to the system. Then you have an exploit. Anytime you have someone taking over your computer, it's because someone is doing something the programmer didn't prepare for. Mm-hmm. And so this is Google recognizing that this was a major flaw of ActiveX, and they're trying to handle that eventuality. However, it is still native code, so you are going to be limited to the processors that you go on there. Like the stuff that you put on there for an Intel processor is not going to work on an ARM processor, for example. Mm-hmm. An ARM processor. Never mind. And at the same time, while Google is trying to push for other browser vendors to adopt this technology, which would be very useful for things like, native games that run at native speeds, applications that are very processor intensive that wouldn't work so well with JavaScript. Other browser manufacturers have been very cool in the response. None to my knowledge, other than Google, have announced any plans to support sodium chloride, NACL. I don't know whether to call it sodium chloride or to call it NACL or to call it salt.
Yeah, that's a good question.
But I'll call it NACL for now.
Salt. NACL. That's not, it's an edgy name. It's good.
Google NACL.
Google.
Chrome NACL, yeah.
No, it makes me think of shackles, which is not a good thing for Google to associate themselves with.
But it is an open spec, and someone could implement it, and it's not tied to the object model like ActiveX was. So the idea is that you're not tying it to, to Windows, or you're not tying it to Linux, or you're not tying it to Mac OS X. It is a – right now you're just tied to Chrome browser.
So instead of OSs, we have browsers.
And speaking of browsers, GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Cruise.io Internet, offering commuters quiet drop-in office space with a 10 gigabit fiber internet connection at 877 Cedar Street in downtown Santa Cruz. Information is at cruise.io.com.
That's fast.
Yes. 10 gigabit is fast. And KOSP co-sponsors Dancing Down Broadway, celebration of musical legends like Irving Berlin and Stephen Sondheim, staged by the Santa Cruz Follies. Final performance at 7 p.m. tonight at the Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium. Information is at 423-6640 or online at santacruzfollies.net. You are listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, and the phone lines are open. If you want to call in with your questions and comments, we can handle, well, very limited things. We are but men. The phone numbers are 877-655-5877, or if you're local, area code 831-476-2800. And in the meantime, while we're waiting for those calls to come in, I'm going to go with Ben for our next story.
Hey, thanks for choosing me. So this is a pretty interesting story to me. They're talking about building a $300 million cable, a 3,000-mile, $300 million fiber optic link between America and all those people over the other side of the Atlantic.
So is this for having high-quality audio gear and a great speaker set?
No, this is actually for... This is actually for shaving a couple milliseconds off the connection between America and the other coast. So going across the Atlantic...
A couple milliseconds.
So currently, the fastest you can get is 65 milliseconds is the fastest you can get from one continent to the other.
To get a message back and forth.
Back and forth. But this thing that they're calling it the Hibernian Express, will cut 6 milliseconds off of that. So about 9% faster. So we're talking 59 milliseconds instead of 65 milliseconds. So this isn't just for your web browsing.
Wait, and they're paying $300 billion for this?
Million.
$300 million for this.
Yes.
Okay, that's better.
$300 billion is a lot of money.
Right. So who's going to take advantage of this too?
Well, here's actually something I never really thought of as far as internet latency and everything. Hedge funds and trading, right? If you can get the trade through a little bit faster than other people, then you end up making a lot more money, right? And we can conceptualize this with maybe 5 seconds difference or 1 second difference, but it turns out that it's been calculated that roughly a 1 millisecond advantage could be worth roughly $100 million every year to the bottom line of any of the large hedge funds. So if they have a 1 millisecond advantage over their competitors, then that could be a lot of money.
So that makes up for $300 million. Then.
Yeah, exactly. Right there, bam. I said bam twice today, I think. Or maybe that was before the show. Anyway, so pretty cool stuff. Unfortunately, that it's probably not going to be the kind of connection that you get your internet through, because there would be a huge, huge, huge premium for using this line. Right.
Okay.
Huge premium. So because, I mean, we have plenty
at
of undersea cables. Yeah. Well, at least not yet. Yeah. I mean, the last undersea cables, I think, according to this article, if I'm remembering right, were laid in the 90s, the dot-com boom. And that's how they were funded. And telecoms built all this infrastructure going across the Atlantic. And there hasn't really been much work ever since. And so,
Were they fiber optic lines to begin with, or were they copper lines, if you're talking about?
I don't know. They might be.
That's
something I should probably look up, but it didn't say in the article that I read, at least.
No, if anyone knows, please call in.
Yeah.
800-655-5877. And speaking of calling in, we have a comment from Jeffrey in Santa Cruz. Hello, Jeffrey. You're on the air.
Hello there. So you were wondering about the legality of that contract?
Yes.
And the answer is, of course, that America is the land of the free, and you have the right to a free contract, except as there may be a law that restricts that.
Okay.
And so a good starting point on this conversation is, have you ever stood on a chair?
Yes.
Did the chair fall through? Because, after all, it's not built for that use. Chair did not fall through,
it depends.
Right?
On a wicker chair, yes, I have fallen through. On
okay,
standard chairs,
so
yes,
you've
I
seen
have.
That.
Right.
In general, chairs don't, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay, do you know why?
I'm sure you will tell me.
I am, because in the tort system, the courts developed the doctrine of foreseeable misuse. And the manufacturer could be held responsible for the foreseeable misuse of the product.
Okay.
And therefore, chairs got built so you wouldn't fall through, generally.
So,
okay, so there are two limits on the ability of a corporation to provide you a product that kills you and keep the money.
Okay.
The two limits are regulation and statute and tort law. And so in the interest of the profitability of business, regulation is handled through what's called regulatory capture. You keep the salaries low. You offer high salaries in the private sector for people who have experience with the regulator. And you gradually produce more expertise about the regulatory agency outside in the hands of the private interest than inside in the government. And you convert the regulatory agency into a servant of the industry. That's regulatory capture.
And now we've gone really geeky in a way I wasn't expecting on this show. Thank you.
Uh-huh. And the other leg for the poor consumer is the tort system. Now, if you get major damage, you can sue all by yourself. But if you get nicked for $10, you're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. Or $100. You have to have a class action. And so one of the attacks has been upon class action, as well as, of course, the chronic bleat about tort reform.
Right. And this is one of the area where Sony was working with their PlayStation Network
trying to cut off the class action. Yeah. So these adhesion contracts have another front in this war is that the adhesion contracts are providing that you must accept arbitration. And it's the same game. And generally the idea is to eliminate your legal remedies and leave you at the mercy of big business. And that's the program.
Thank you so much for that that elucidation. I'm always happy when people with a background in law call in because we are not lawyers.
Yeah, okay. I know. So that's what's going on.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
you bet.
All right, take care.
Ciao.
And on a completely different note,
mm-hmm.
we have Dan calling in from Santa Cruz. Migrating from OS X?
Hello. Yeah. What my question was is, actually, I've been thinking since I was on hold, the best way to migrate, I have a MacBook Pro, want to buy one of the new iMacs, and I want to migrate my user account, or I've actually made a disk image with Drive Genius, so I'm wondering if that's the better way of doing it. I cloned my system.
Well, so. Is your MacBook Pro still working?
Oh yeah, it's like a 2008 MacBook.
Well,
Pro.
Then all you have to do, especially if you're getting the newest version of OS X, because you can do it through Wi-Fi, I'm assuming.
Uh huh.
But at any rate, and you can do it by Ethernet.
You don't want to do it through Wi-Fi. So what we're talking about
is you can do through FireWire, but you can connect up to two computers. So
you're talking
about
Migration Assistant, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you start up the new iMac, it can prompt you to say, do you want to start up a new system? Do you want to restore from a backup? Or do you want to migrate from an existing computer, upgrade from an existing computer?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And so you can upgrade from your MacBook Pro, and it'll take all of your software, all of your user settings, and throw it onto the new machine.
Yeah, it actually does a very good job. I just upgraded from Snow Leopard to Lion, and I couldn't do an upgrade. I had to do a clean install for really bizarre, crazy reasons. But I did it, and then I actually I used Migration Assistant to grab stuff from a backup that I had made. But in order to get your MacBook Pro to act basically as a hard drive, what you want to do is just connect it up with a FireWire cable. That's probably your best bet, because you're also going to get very good transfer speeds. And when you turn on your MacBook Pro, hold down the T key.
But actually, I don't know that you need to do this anymore. On the Migration Assistant, I've done this before when I was transferring from one machine to another. You can have the source machine, you turn on Migration Assistant, and so you're doing a migration from that computer. You don't need to reboot into target mode.
Mm. Are you sure?
Can you use the crossover cable and use Ethernet like you were saying, so you get that gigabit transfer?
You probably could.
Yeah.
I've never done it.
Actually, I think you can use a standard Ethernet cable, because ports nowadays will sense whether or not you're going to a hub or going to another end machine. So they'll do the crossover for you.
Oh, technically that's faster, right, than the 800 FireWire?
I think the 800 FireWire would be faster, because there are a couple reasons.
I think your limitation is going to be your hard drive speed.
Yeah.
So either one is going to be fine.
Well, it depends on if you're 800 or 400 FireWire, 800.
But all those apps are going to be able to run as long as they were in, the 64-bit apps, they'll run. Well, even if they're 32-bit, all those apps will run fine, right?
From a MacBook Pro to an iMac, they should, yes.
Yeah.
And
that's what I was worried about. I don't want to have a disaster and then have to reinstall everything.
That's also why you have Time Machine backups, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So
are you going from something like Snow Leopard to Lion? Is Lion on your new...
Yeah, Lion's going to be on the new iMac. Yeah. I'm assuming it will
the
be.
The only potential problem that you could have that I could see, the only predictable problem at least, is that you may run into an issue where you have a really, really old application that runs just on PowerPC processors, and it's being emulated with Rosetta. And so Lion actually ditches that functionality. So you probably won't have an issue, because pretty much all of the apps worth keeping have changed over from Rosetta to be on the new processor architecture, but you might have a potential problem with any really old applications that you're running.
Yeah, I think everything's Cocoa that I'm using, so it should be good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right on. Thank you for your help.
Thank you for your call.
Thanks.
All right, bye.
So now we must move on to a new story. What are we going to cover now? Ben?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I have a geek bit.
Go.
Happy Programmer Day.
Programmer Day was a few days ago.
Yeah, that's true. you would know that, right? I was hoping...
Actually, I tweeted about it.
Did you tweet it?
Yeah, I know.
I thought you were one of those one-tweet wonders. Like, you open an account, and then you tweet something like, is this thing on? And then you never touch it again.
I was, and then I tweeted a second one saying, all right, I'm going to try this again. And then I did a third tweet, which was, Happy Programmer Day. And, yeah, I haven't done anything since.
Really? So that's been your only real tweet has been Programmer Day. That's fantastic. So, Programmer Day, Tuesday, this last Tuesday. So, happy Programmer Day.
Now, why is it Programmer Day, Ben?
Let me read this article really fast.
Okay, fine.
I don't know.
It's Programmer Day.
Go for it. It's the 256th, right?
Yes, it's 256th day of the year.
Why not the 128th?
128th.
It's a geeky number.
Yeah. 128th is 7-bit. 256 is 8-bit.
Yeah.
It's the highest. I mean, and we think of terms in terms of 8-bit bytes nowadays, so that makes more sense.
But do you have a problem with the number 7? I kind of like that number.
When I'm programming? Yeah. I like 8-bit numbers.
Okay, fair enough.
That's what we work with. Yeah, FF. It's very simple.
Well, are you starting at 0 or are you starting at 1?
Well, the days of the year start at January 1st.
Is January 1st the 0th day, though?
That's the thing, though, is if you're converting between the two, it's 255 is the 256th number.
That makes sense. So programmer day is
in a zero oriented.
The last day that can be represented, if you were to represent each day as
if
one.
If January 1st were zero.
Or as one number.
Yeah, if January 1st were zero, then this past Tuesday was the 256th day of the year.
Well, why don't we celebrate the, like, Wednesday, the 257th day, index number 256, because that's when we break out of our 8-bit paradigm,
because that would be
right?
Day 100.
Yeah.
Not FF.
1000000.
No.
Yeah. Right?
No, in hex, 100.
Oh, okay. Hex, sure. When were we talking in hex? Okay, fair
enough. If we're talking about programmer day, we're not talking about binary.
So Tuesday was FF.
Hex is used far more often.
Tuesday was FF, and then Wednesday is 100.
Yes.
Okay. Wow.
So Tuesday was the last day that you can represent with a two-digit hexadecimal number.
This is Geek Speak. Sometimes bridging the gap between, no.
And the phone numbers are 800-655-5877 or 831-476-2800. Actually, I realized as we were talking about this that maybe we could try describing what hexadecimal is. Because
okay.
I'm sure we left a whole bunch of people out of the loop there.
So hexadecimal is kind of cool. Also, for any web developers who don't understand the, you know, pound 36FDC9 or whatever, that's hexadecimal, right?
Wait, if any programmers don't understand that, that's
web developers.
Oh, web developers.
If any web developers. You can write CSS and not understand it.
Yeah, that's true.
You don't need to. You just go to a color picker online and it gives you this magical code and then it works.
Right.
Yeah. So...
So 0000FF is blue. If folks have ever seen that before when doing a web page.
Yeah.
Now, the reason why. First off, let's start with, why are we counting from zero?
Well, it makes more sense, right?
Most people say you start counting from one. You go 1, 2, 3. Why?
Well, if you start a timer and then you stop it exactly 1 second later, if you start counting from one, the timer will read 2.
Well, most people, they think of, they start the timer and then they go 1, 2, 3. So,
yeah, but they're wrong.
Well, the thing is, if you're talking about binary, if you're talking about a light switch, for example, that would be a clear example for someone of binary. It's either on or off. You're starting from zero. Your first state is off, is zero, and then one is on. And as you start counting from there, it makes more sense to count from zero, especially if you only have positive numbers.
Because mm-hmm.
otherwise, how else would you describe zero? Zero is important. You got to have zero. So zero makes sense being first.
Mm-hmm.
If you have negative numbers, that's a whole other thing. You can go down. But if you just have a positive number, then you're starting
at zero. Start with zero, you go to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Right.
Yeah.
And the thing is, for us human beings, we think of, oh, well, we'll count to 10. You know, and when mm-hmm. we run out of numbers, you know, you start from zero, you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and we run out of specific distinct digits for number counting. So we just take another one and we put it in front.
In fact, if you
and
think
then
back
goes
to,
zero, then we have 10, 1,
if you
zero.
Think back to kindergarten, when they said, this is the ones place, this is the tens place, this is the hundreds place.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you look back on that and you think, oh, those teachers, they were just talking down to us because we didn't understand. No. Actually, that's the basis. That's the crux of our base 10 number system, is that you can represent the numbers 0 through 9 with one digit. And then as soon as you get to 10, that's actually 1 in the tens place and 0 in the ones place.
Or you think about a clock. When you're looking at a clock and you see, you know, 1 o'clock and you see 100, and the next one is 01, 02, 03, 04, 05, 06, 07, 08, 09.
10.
And then 10, 11, 12. Except that computers don't handle 10 very well.
Mm-mm.
10, you know, five times two.
And also, if you're going to build something, if you're going to build some very, very, very small component that can represent some number of numbers, it's kind of difficult to find something that has 10 distinct states and control them. Whereas a switch is really, really easy, right? It's just on or off, or right. A magnetic bit
well,
is on or off.
Computers like things being on or off, like being what we call base 2, 1 or 0.
Mm-hmm.
And they like powers of 2. Just like we like human beings, we like powers of 10. We like 10, 100, 1,000. It's all a power of 10. Computers like powers of 2. So 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512, 1024.
Yeah.
And for programmers, those are as natural for numbers as 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000 is for the general population.
And actually, for me, more meaningful. When I see 256 on the clock, that's a lot more meaningful than 2 o'clock or 1 o'clock
right.
or whatever.
And that going from what's called a base 16, in other words, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, A, B, C, D, E, F.
That's 16 distinct digits. And
right.
the only reason we go into letters
or
is
zero,
just
one, two, three, four, five,
because
yeah.
in our base 10 brains, we don't have single-digit numbers to represent 11 or 12
right.
or 13 or 16 or 15, I mean.
Right. And then at the end, when you get to F, it's like 0F. That turns into a 1-0, like what we would think of as 10, but it's actually...
Same thing. It spills
actually,
over. It puts 1 into the
it's
next
actually 16.
Numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So we have the... with binary, we have the 1's place, 2's place, 4's place, 8's place, 16's place, all the way up, all those numbers that we were just counting. And then in hexadecimal, we have the 1's place, and then we have
the 16's
place, and then we have the
256's place.
Yeah, so we're multiplying by 16 every time instead of multiplying by 2 with like with binary or by 10 like our number system.
Mm-hmm. And then you have these 65,536 plates.
So here's the question I have for you, Miles, then. What's the connection between binary and hexadecimal? Because computers are really good in counting as between 0 and 1, but we were just talking about a number system from 0 to 15, which is
right.
16 different numbers.
If you have a single hexadecimal number, that is the equivalent of 4 binary numbers. It's directly applicable.
Wait, 2 is 8, right?
If you have 1,
oh,
1, 1, 1, that is equivalent to 16 in binary, or 15 rather. And that is 15 in hexadecimal,
which
or
F.
And so no matter how many bits you have, you can use hexadecimal to see how that gets handled. You don't want to have in a program... Oh, I want to be able to have up to 100 people in my phone book because you're going to waste a whole lot of space. The computer doesn't handle 100 very well.
So
it does handle 127 mm-hmm. very well, and it handles 60, you know, or and it handles 63 pretty well. It or
one less than all of the powers of 2, right?
Right.
From 0 to 63, that's 64 distinct numbers.
Right.
And that's a power of 2, a very important power of 2, 64 is.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you want to have this middle ground with the computer when you're working with it. You want to be able to use a numbering system that works for the computer and is reasonably understood by human beings because binary is just a bear. That's
yeah.
just, you know, any character would be a series of... you know, 8 or more
zeros and ones.
Yeah. And to count up, like, that's an A, that's an H, that's a, you know, that doesn't work very well.
So
for
you
us.
Were saying then that, so one hexadecimal number, either 0 all the way up through F, can be represented as 4 binary numbers, 4 zeros or ones, right?
4 bits, yeah.
So that means that 2 hexadecimal numbers can be represented by 8 bits. And 8 bits is really special. 8 bits is a byte. Right.
8 bits is the byte that we have standardized on. There's
sure,
no
sure.
reason why it has to be 8 bits,
it
but
could
that's
be something
what we've
else, but...
that's what's been most easy for us because 8 is also a power of 2.
So that means that if you want to represent the amount of red in a particular pixel with one byte, then you should give it 8 bits or 8 binary numbers or 2 hexadecimal numbers. And if you were to do that, give 2 hexadecimal numbers to the red and the blue or green and the blue in a particular pixel, you would end up with a hexadecimal color value, something like FFCC99 or whatever.
Right, but that's being very esoteric. Think of it more simply this way. You have 3 flashlights. One of them has a red filter on it, one of them has a green filter on it, and one of them has a blue filter on it. Red, green, blue, RGB. I'm sure many people have heard that term before, but don't necessarily know what it stands for. It means red, green, blue. And if you have all 3 flashlights on at the same time pointing to the same point, that light is going to look white.
Yeah, because you're throwing all 3 of these colors more and more and more light at the wall, you're going to end up with white. And if you throw none of it at the wall, you're going to end up with black, right?
Right.
And if you throw only a whole bunch of red at the wall and not very much green or blue, you're going to end up with a reddish color
right.
light or something like that.
Right, that's obvious. You have a red flashlight, it's going to be red. If you have a blue flashlight, it's going to be blue. If you have a green flashlight, it's going to be green. If you have all three of them, you're going to have white, which is all colors. White mean white in terms of light is all color, or at least for our visible spectrum.
Yeah, and this is just kind of a way of representing color. You could use different colors to do it, but red, green, blue works very well.
Right. Now imagine that you have a dial on those flashlights where you're able to dial it back from the flashlight being off to the flashlight being, you know, kind of on, like a dimmer switch for it. Mm-hmm. And you had that for all three flashlights, the red, the green, and the blue. If it was off, that's 00. If it's all the way on, that's FF. And as you're dialing that up, you're going 01, 02, 03, 04, and going up
0A,
those numbers.
0B, 0C, 0F, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14.
So it's like a dimmer switch with 256 steps in it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have those three flashlights and you do those steps, you are able to get a 24-bit value, or basically slightly more colors than almost every human eye can see. Human eye on average can see about 14 million colors, and 24 bits, or in other words, three 8-bit values.
16 billion, or it's 16. Almost
17. 16.7 million.
16.777 million.
Is it 0.77?
0.777216.
Okay.
Or we could just say 16,777,000.
It's easier to refer to as 16.7 million, but that's a bad rounding off apparently. But yeah, that's...
Yeah, math that floor on that. but well, it's better than overestimating.
But this is how it works when you're making web pages and you want blue, is that you have this 0000FF.
So that's no red, no green, full blue, full on blue.
Right.
And if
so
you want a lighter...
The blue flashlight is on. Is the only one that's on. It's on full blast, and you have blue.
And if you want a lighter blue, then you just add some red and add some green to it, which if you kind of think of it instead of, you know, adding red and adding green, you can think of it as you've got this really blue color, which is 00000FF, and then you've got white, which is FFFFFF, right? All three of them. If you kind of merge those together and you get something like, I don't know, AAAFF, then you get a very light blue color.
Right.
Yeah.
You're taking that blue and you're getting closer to white. No, so now that we've completely...
alienated
most of the audience. Although it is a very cool subject, and if you do know how to do hexadecimal and you get that more familiar in your head, handling computers and understanding why computers are doing things will make so much more sense. It really is worth learning.
The other thing is if you're working on web development for a client and you just pull a random number out of your head and you say, oh, let's try CCBBDD, and they're like, oh my God, that's exactly the color. They think you're a genius. They think you're a wizard.
Which
it's
means
amazing.
That you can charge more money.
Exactly.
We have a call from Martha, who's on the side of the road coming up from Big Sur. I'm sorry to have to make you wait, as she's being so patient and waiting for us. She has an answer for us about the transatlantic cables we were talking about before. Hello, Martha. You're on the air.
Hello. It's true. I do have an answer. First time I think I've ever known anything about what you're talking about.
And that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to bring people into that geek fold.
And yet you listen anyway.
We're bridging that gap.
Well, I always figure I got nothing to lose. You can always learn something new.
Awesome.
I spent 20 years going to sea. I retired in 1999 as a cable ship captain, and I can tell you that we started testing underwater fiber telephone cable in the early 80s. We installed our first fiber optic transatlantic cable in about 88, 89, and then the second generation started going in about 92, 93. The first generation was online signal regenerators, so it was slow and didn't have the capacity. And the second one actually was online optical amplifiers. So that was the big step that happened in the 90s. I think we're up to 12 transatlantic cables now, and of which the last 12 or 13 and the last 4 or 5, I believe, are still fiber and probably will be. Once the new technology is in place, my guess is that they'll probably retrofit those into the higher capacity cables if we've got a new system. But I'm retired, so I don't know what they're doing now, but that's the answer.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I was thinking that we had to have fiber with Europe, but I didn't want to say anything because I've been so wrong in the past. Like, for example, when I had a GeekBit talking about orange carrots and the fact that they were political from William of Orange, it turns out that that story is apocryphal, and I'm so sorry for spreading misinformation. It's what I get for for reading something on the internet and taking it as true.
That's what keeps you up at night, huh? You wake up, oh no, was I spreading misinformation again?
I do actually. So if we're ever wrong, I do highly recommend people call in. And if we have a gap in our knowledge, we learn as much as everyone else does. Thank you so much for calling in, Martha.
Yeah.
You're very welcome.
All right.
Thanks.
And we are coming up near the end of the show. Do you have any geek bits?
Oh, I just want to say, Martha, shoot us an email too, because that would be a really interesting potential show topic even, you know, like just talking about how all of that got set up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so shoot us an email. But yeah, I do have another geek bit. The Google Plus API is finally here, kind of.
Okay, so kind of. For people who aren't geeks... What did you just say? Wait, Google Plus API. What is this?
So Google Plus is the new Facebook-like social networking site, kind of aiming to take on Facebook in certain ways. And the API is the way you can write an application and interface with Facebook or interface with Google Plus and interface with all of their information and build things upon their platform and their product. So instead of Google Plus or Facebook just being something that you go to and play with, it's something that you can actually build other things off of, you know?
Just like other people have websites that use Google Maps.
Exactly.
Other sites have, you know, Twitter feeds that come in. That's the type of API that we're talking about here.
Exactly. So unfortunately, it's not the entire API. This is just the public data API. So this is any data that is public, nothing that's privileged or private between friends or anything like that. And it's a read-only thing as well. But if you build applications, that's kind of cool, and you can build all kinds of cool stuff.
Thank you. And GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence, and we thank the Puppet Master for its use. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at KUSP.org. Save Our Shores announces their 2011 annual Coastal Cleanup Day on Saturday, September 17th from 9 a.m. to noon at over 50 sites in Santa Cruz County and over 30 sites in Monterey County. All cleanup materials will be provided, and volunteers are encouraged to help lower the carbon footprint of this event by bringing their own bucket, reusable bags, and gloves to help reduce single-use disposables. Information and registration is available at saveourshores.org/ACC. Once again, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Ben Jaffe, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. Thank you, Miles Elam, for hosting the show.
It has been my pleasure. Once again, thank you, everyone, for calling in. If it wasn't for you, it would just be us geeking out, and who wants to listen to that?
I would.
Coming up next is Car Talk. Thank you for listening.